Welcome to Endeavors. Kick it, boys. Good afternoon, Radio Land, and welcome to Endeavors on CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby, up atop the mountain at Simon Fraser University. It's 5 o'clock, and it's already pitch black out. Weather's not too bad, a little chilly, but only 6 more days left of fall, 6 days until the equinox. We are also on the internet at cjsf.ca and TELUS HD channel 7014. The number here is 778-782-CJSF. That's 778-782-2573. Well, there are only 3 Endeavors shows left here in 2014. This week, the 22nd, and December the 29th. So, I thought we would start, for the next 3 weeks, we would do a best of Endeavors. This week, we're going to be doing arts. So, we've got 3 great interviews. We've got music, we've got acting, and we've got a documentary filmmaker. Of course, as you know, many of the interviews on Endeavor cross genres, so the musician also wrote a book, the documentary filmmaker is about social justice issues, but, you know, arts, and then you'll hear some more next week, and then, of course, the 29th will wrap things up. So stay tuned for that. First, though, we have a couple of announcements for you. So please bear with us. Welcome back. So as I mentioned, this week is the first of our best of end of the year stuff. And we have 3 great interviews that we're recapping today. The first one aired only about a month and a half ago, sort of the beginning of November. Alan Doyle is the lead singer of Great Big Sea, and he also has his in the process of releasing his second solo album. His first solo album, Boy on Bridge, was released in 2012. He also just wrote a new book called Where I Belong, and I had the chance to speak with Alan back in November. Makes his living as the lead singer of the great Newfoundland Celtic rock band. He also has released a solo record, Boy on Bridge, in 2012. And in January, will be releasing his second solo record, So Let's Go. He is also an actor and has appeared in a small film called Robin Hood with actors Russell Crowe and Cate Blanchett, directed by Ridley Scott, and also guest starred with Russell Crowe on the CBC hit show Republic of Doyle. His first acting credit came as an extra in 1979 as The Boy on Bridge. He is Alan Doyle. His new memoir is Where I Belong. I had the chance to speak with him on Friday about his life and career. Here is my conversation with Alan Doyle.
The pleasure to be joined by musician, actor, and now author. He is the lead singer of Great Big Sea. His new book is Where I Belong, Small Town to Great Big Sea. Alan Doyle, hello. Where are you at?
What are you at? Well, I'm doing good, man. I'm good. I'm very glad to be here. Lovely Vancouver. And talking about stories growing up in Petty Harbour. Pretty lucky.
enjoying the West Coast?
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. The West Coast has always been like a funny place for me because, you know, it's like the East Coast. Of course, it's on the ocean. Yet the oceans don't have any. They don't look the same at all. You know, like, and it's a completely different vibe of like. I don't know. It just feels like the East Coast is, you know, the ocean is where you go to work and drown. And the West Coast, you know, the ocean is quite pleasant, you know, it's a nice thing. It's strange to see.
So why now? Why was this time the right time for you to write the book?
The whole thing came to me, to be honest, in the strangest kind of confession. It wasn't my idea at all. Like, it came to me that Random House Canada came to me late in 2012 and said that they'd been reading a blog I was writing on the Great Big Sea website for a while. And they asked me if I'd be interested in writing a book. And I started writing some of the stories down that I've been telling, you know, in the pub or whatever, about my crazy little fishing town. And they fell in love with the idea, and so I just kept going. I rolled most all the way through 2013 on the Great Big Sea Tour, writing this book in the downtime, and just really a reflection and a love letter to my own family and to my young life in Petty Harbor.
How does writing a book for you differ from writing a song?
Well, the duration of it is the big thing. I know it's probably obvious, but like, if I spend more than a few hours writing a song, 9 times out of 10, that means it's not a very good idea for a song. If it doesn't come quicker than that, then it's probably not going to come, you know. Whereas, of course, for a book, it's much more of a longer story arc, and it's a lot more, you can kind of get away with a lot more detail and a lot more, you know, you can explain things a lot more. And it's, and I mean, I've only ever written one book, so I can't really speak to it much more than that, you know, but it just, the big thing for me was how long it takes. I'm used to working on things that last for 90 minutes, right? And you wake up the next day and you're off to another one. And with a book, I felt like, you know, on month 7, I would go to my editor, I'd joke, we can't be working on the same thing we were working on in October. Is this the same thing? We must have done something else by then.
And Newfoundland, I got from this book, has a very distinct identity from the rest of Canada. Part of it, you know, comes that it's only been a province for 65 years. But what does being a Doyle from Petty Harbor mean to you, and what does being a Newfoundlander mean to you?
Well, being a Doyle from Petty Harbor always was a very simple thing, is that the Doyles were an odd family in Petty Harbor because most of them weren't fishermen. None of my uncles, my grandfather, his brothers, they all worked different jobs, and so that's odd in a fishing town. And the other, of course, odd thing is that the Doyles are the musicians, the jesters, the minstrels in town. And for a couple of generations or more, the Doyles are the ones, the go-to family for the concerts or for the church choir or for the band, for the dance, you know. And it's always been a very musical family. And so I find great comfort in knowing that I'm kind of a part of, you know, kind of a legacy, like, of a family, you know, in Petty Harbor, where we've been the entertainers for a long time, you know, and that's a cool thing to be a part of that flow, you know, that, and being a Newfoundlander, I don't know, I mean, it's, I try not to dwell too much on, you know, whether I'm a Newfoundlander or a Canadian or a, you know, I'm just me, you know, and I think one of the things I like about Canada and the country is how much it supports its regions. You know, like, it's one of those places where you don't have to be, you know, a guy from Saskatchewan or a Canadian. If you're a guy from Saskatchewan, then you're a Canadian. If you're a Newfoundlander, then you're a Canadian. If you're, you know, and the story I always tell about Canada, and like, is, I was in a car one time, Toronto, it was a cab, I guess, and then the radio station, I can't remember which radio station, but they played 4 songs in a little pack. And they played Our Lady Peace, Susan the Glue Cart, Celine Dion, and Great Big Sea. And I said, find me one other country in the world where those 4 acts get played on the same radio station. Find me a country where those people would have even met. And I was like, that's 4 people that have absolutely nothing in common at all. Like, and they're all Canadian. And it's so great.
You mentioned that you come from the long line of musicians, but when did you first realize that you could be the first professional musician from the Doyle family?
August 3rd, 1993. Yeah, the day our first record. I always wanted to... generation or two of Doyles being musicians, there was never one of them that ever had a record out. And the day that record showed up, man, I felt like I, that, you know, someone asked me last night about a bucket list. I said, I don't really have a bucket list. I only ever had one thing on it. I was like, I want to be in a band that has a record. And I did that that day, and it was just like, I felt like that was a significant contribution to the Doyle legacy, you know, and yeah. And yeah, I mean, everything since then has been great.
But I mean, how important are the subsequent records in relation to the first one that you put out?
It's all part of the chain, but the, you know, the, and all the learning of how to do it, and it's such a joy to get to learn that whole craft, you know, over the last 20 years or whatever, and I'm still learning. But there's nothing compares to that first one for me. That was easily, you know, the most proud I've ever been in anything in my life.
Newfoundland and even all of Atlantic Canada has a very strong, heavy, and very distinct musical culture. Yourselves, you get the Rankins, Graham McNeil, all these fiddle players. Mm-hmm. What is it about that part of the country? Why is there this such rich musical culture compared to other parts of the country?
Well, I'm not totally sure, and I don't think anyone is, but I've thought for the longest while that in Atlantic Canada, you know, those places were settled by very musical cultures, right? You know, Cape Breton Island was settled by Scottish pipers and fiddlers, you know, and Newfoundland was settled by Irish singers, and they were left alone for a long time. You know, like, unlike if you were, for example, I don't know, a Ukrainian guy who moved to Edmonton, if you were alongside other non-Ukrainians really quickly and for a long time. That never happened in Newfoundland. It never happened in Cape Breton. You know, dudes left Southern Ireland and then moved en masse to Harbour Grace or wherever. And then they were right next to Irish guys. So that culture that left Ireland or wherever came to those places in Atlantic Canada and didn't get mixed with anything else. You know, it became that thing. And so the stuff that happened 200 years ago in, you know, in Western Scotland or in Southern Ireland are happening in Atlantic Canada right now. You know, it's because up until 40 or 50 years ago, those cultures were still the same. And I think the other part of it is that in those parts of the more rural parts of Canada, you know, the people work really hard and the life is hard, you know, so they need a Saturday night out, right? And unlike anywhere else, even smaller towns in the middle of North America somewhere, there's no bus rolling in Saturday night with a bunch of minstrels from the next state over, or from the cavalcade is not rolling through Petty Harbour on a Friday night. There's nobody coming to give you entertainment. You have to make it, right? It's yours to make, and so you do, you know. And I think in the blood of it all, that's probably a big part of it. But and then you have the other parts that are probably simpler, like the people are just, you know, inclined to have a good time.
Yeah.
Hard work breeds hard party. Yeah.
One of my favorite stories in the book is you mentioned going to a bar, I think, with your uncle. You're probably about 10 or 11. And they're sitting there and you're testing out all the equipment. You're smelling the mic. So when you're about to go on stage, what do you want to feel? What do you want to see before you go out there and give a two-hour show?
Oh, just I just want it to be the greatest night of everyone's life, every night. It's like, it's magic, man. It's still magic that this day and age, where entertainment is so varied and so digital and so people can do almost anything they want any time, that it's amazing to me that people's favorite thing to do still is to go stand in rows next to each other and everybody faces the same direction and watches a guy up in front of a microphone stand singing songs to them. That's ancient now. Yet people still love it. They love that thing that and that to me is a miracle. It's a miracle that still happens and that people are still moved by that. So, you know, I often get asked, like, how do you get up for the concert, you know, or whatever. It's like, I never had any trouble getting up for the concert. I trouble getting up for the 5 a.m. flight.
The next morning, yeah.
The concerts are magical, man.
Well, you've got, and I've had the fortune to see you a few times, but you've got party songs like Patty Murphy or Mary Mac, and then you've got slower songs like Boston and St. John's and England. Yeah. Does your mindset or approach change for the different styles?
Yeah. Just like the way I grew up, right? You'd be in the kitchen party or whatever in my house, and, when someone's playing a bunch of fiddle tunes or accordion tunes or whatever, everyone would be talking and having a grand old time, and then someone would go to sing a party song and everyone would sing along, and then someone would go sing a ballad and everyone would hush, for the bet. Like, it's just, I tried to take that whole feeling, that intimacy of that kind of it with me, no matter if I'm playing for 5 people or 5,000, to me, that vibe is beautiful.
You've talked a lot in your book about the religious divide in the town and how you have little F faith, I think you called it,
yeah.
the lowercase faith. What sort of an impact did not only you growing up Catholic, but just the whole divide, how did the community be split in two? What impact did that have on you musically, do you think?
I'm not sure it had much of an impact musically, honestly, other than it, perhaps somewhere in my lyrics I became fascinated with faith and religion. Lyrically, I suppose. And I suppose the fact that I learned to play guitar in the Catholic Church, folky, the folk mass parts of it. And I do, I don't know, I still am fascinated lyrically with what people will do in the name of faith and what people will believe in and what they won't believe in. That still freaks me out, like the fact that, I will believe in that sort of outrageous, crazy thing. I don't believe in the guy down the road or something. Like, it just, I don't know. Like, it's a never-ending source of interest to me what people will do in the name of faith and organized religion or the opposite, but there wasn't, when I grew up, a real distinct musical difference between the two sides of the harbor. They liked the same kind of music. They were very similar. That's what's so weird about it. Why are we separate at all? It wasn't like, for example, I think it would have been different if it was a Catholic side of Big Harbor, and on the other side was, for example, Salvation Army or something that had a very distinct musical style. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Where it was marching bands and trumpets and stuff like that. Where we didn't have that. So musically, not necessarily lyrically, but musically, the two sides of the harbor were very similar.
And we talked a little bit about this before the interview, but you started off singing kind of parody and joke songs,
mm-hmm.
in the clubs, in the club scene. You could have been Newfoundland's own Weird Al.
And it's only by the grace of God and Bob Hallett, really, that he talked me out of it. Because I one of the earliest gigs in St. John's was playing in this comedy duo. And I kind of, because I'm a bit of a foolish fella, I thought that was a good way to go, And when Great Big Sea even started, Waddy Yat and songs like that, I was going down that road of being a funny guy, a funny musician. And it was Bob Hallett from Great Big Sea who sat me down when they sat down. You don't want to be a funny band. We don't want to be a funny band. If we're a band that also happens to be funny, that's good. We don't want to be a funny band, because if you're a funny band, you got to be funny every single time. And I'm so grateful to him for that conversation and that direction about let humor be a bonus to people when they show up. But you're right. I mean, left to my own devices, I might have gone down that, because there was such a history of that in St. John's,
yeah.
Right? Codco and This Hour's 22 Minutes and Rick Mercer and all those people were funny people. That's who made it. By and large, it was funny, and so I figured I'll be funny and I'll be all right.
You brief a few songs in here, Helmet Head, Consequence Free, but arguably your most famous is Ordinary Day, with that famous opening, Way Hey Hey.
Yeah.
What is it, why do you think that song, what has made it resonate with so many people for so many years?
I'm not sure. And that's a good thing. If I knew, I'd probably shag it up. I think the message in it speaks to people because it's, in good times, it's good to have a song that's positive and uplifting to match your mood. in dark times, it's even more important to have a positive, you know, reminder that, you know, this day will pass just like all the other ones. It's only 24 hours in the shittiest day of your life, and there's only 24 hours in the greatest day of your life.
Yeah.
They're both going to pass. One feels like it goes by in a blink, and one feels like it goes by, you know, at the snail's pace. But they don't. They go. They tick. The clock ticks the same both days, and it's just an ordinary day. It's all right, you know. It's and I don't know, that sentiment, I suppose, lived with me for a long time about, and I think that people respond to that notion, even though it's a very simple one. Also, it benefited from really good timing when it was released. It was released right when the band was kicking off, and it was kind of sailory sound, and it reminded people of Newfoundland. It was a little bit pop and a little bit Celtic, and it had an easy chorus to sing along. And it was right when Much Music in Canada was still playing a lot of Canadian music videos. And we happened to put out a really good video for that song, and it got played a lot. And so it just stuck with people, you know. And, yeah.
When you guys had that first hit, mm-hmm. is that when you're like, and you talked about, you know, putting the record out earlier, but when you had that first hit that was heard by mass numbers across the country,
yeah.
did you think, this is it?
No. There was never really a moment. Great Big Sea Success was always so gradual and always kind of a little off the radar. I mean, people are very surprised to learn that we never really had a hit song. I think the highest we ever got on the Canadian chart was like 11. Number 9. See If No Cares got to number 9 one time. That's it. Like, you know, you look it up, it's like we never had a hit song. We had videos that got played quite popular and all that, and we played a lot of concerts, so but we never, there was never like this time when there was this song or something or that went ahead of us. You know, that we arrived in Germany and we were number 6. You know,
yeah.
Never happened. And so it was all, and we were always kind of, even to this day, like even people, the highest people in the music industry are shocked to see the numbers of Great Big Sea has been, how many tickets? Like, aren't they like some kind of like folk band or something? Like people, our success, it's always been so gradual and slightly off the grid. And that's been the greatest thing that could have ever happened to us. Because we never had anything to fall from.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like we never had a moment that was so big that we couldn't live up to it with the next one. You know, and that's such, sounds so weird, right? But it's such a blessing, man.
I was struck by the fact, you know, a lot of musicians, when they make it big, they go Toronto, Vancouver, Montreal, yet you chose to stay at home.
Yeah.
You're a townie now, and you're living in St. John's.
Right.
Why did you decide to stay where you grew up as opposed to migrate?
I don't know. It's funny. It's only lately I've been thinking about how weird it is that over, you know, 20-odd years now of traveling a lot and going to some of the, you know, most popular places in the world regularly, that it's never once occurred to me to live anywhere else. That's strange, isn't it? You think you'd be tempted one day to go, but I never have been. It's never, I don't know. I moved from Petty Harbour into St. John's because I loved St. John's so much, and I still love St. John's. I love it. I love, you know, and I guess I get my fill of other places by travel and the like, and I don't, I've never been tempted to live anywhere else. I mean, going forward in my life, I could see a time where, if I had the time available to me, I'd spend, you know, a month, a year working on a project in some other place. I've done that a couple of times, and I really like that. Like, I got to live in London for 4 or 5 months, and I was sort of off and on doing the Robin Hood movie, and I lived in New York City for 5 or 6 weeks doing another movie, and that's mom. But I don't know. I can't. I don't ever foresee a time when I don't live. My primary residence isn't home. You know, like, never occurred to me. It's kind of weird. Like, you know, like you think over the years there'd be some point where I go like, yeah, that's the time I almost moved to New Orleans. Just never. It's never even dawned on me. You know?
You know, you've traveled to countless places. And I remember one anecdote you recounted, I think it was your first time playing in Toronto, about how the G and the R fell out and it said Eat Big C.
Okay.
But do you have any favorite stories from the road? That is there one or two that really stick out with you during your...
Yeah, hundreds of stories that have been fantastic or tragic or boring or amazing or exciting or foolish. You know, there's a million, you know, every day it feels like. That's one of the things that's so intoxicating and addictive about traveling in a band to me, is that every day is a new adventure, you know, and it's, you know, I'm too curious not to make every day like a bit of an epic day. But, you know, I don't know, I mean, there's so many of them, man. It's like, I thought it was really cool the first time we ever got to play in the United States. It was amazing, you know, to go play in Lower Manhattan. I remember that day pretty cool. You know, the first time we got to play in England, you know, it's incredible. I remember the first time we played on the mainland in Canada. Huge moment, man. We got to play the Lower Deck Pub in Halifax.
For all those mainlanders.
Yeah, and it was massive because, you know, if you're a little band trying to get off Newfoundland, the most important city in the world, it's not London or New York or Paris, it's Halifax. You... got to have that town or you're broke. It's a long way to go for the next one, you know?
Yeah.
And so I was so delighted when we got to play Halifax and make that a second home almost for a while.
You joke a lot about how you grew up with running water. You grew up, you know, you used a bucket, I think, for the first 5 or 6 years of your life. You didn't even have a shower, I think, until you were 10. So in all your travels, in all the hotel rooms and places you stayed in, what is the most luxurious bathroom you've come across?
When at Robin Hood, that's easy. When Robin Hood was released, the movie, the main cast, which is Russell and Kate Blanchett, Mark Strong, and then the Merry Men, myself, Scott Grimes, Kevin Durant, we all went to we were officially the opening film of the Cannes Film Festival, right? So we all flew over private jets, some was over to Cannes, and, you know, put up in the poshest hotel I've ever been in my life. I can't remember the name of it now. I'm sorry. I can't remember the name of it, but it was the Cannes in this Cannes hotel. It had like, a, you know how sometimes in a fancy hotel there's two toilets?
Yeah.
There was four or five in this one. I never did figure out what they were all for. I'm not sure what you could possibly, what part of you could need four tools to wash it like that, but it was in some French way, I suppose, or something goes on there. I never did figure it out. But that was easily the most luxurious bathroom. It had four things to sit on, two things to get in, and plus like a shower big enough for a hockey team.
And just think to yourself, like, what am I doing here? Like, yeah. I'm just a boy from Petty Harbor, yeah. And I'm in, like, France with Russell Crowe.
Yeah. It was funny. Like, I've had millions of pinch me moments like that. Most of them, though, I kind of, you know, I don't stop for a second to do it because it just shags you up. And plus, I'll probably do in a concert or, you know, where I can't let my mind drift to the ridiculousness of how, you know, where I am because I have a job to do. But over there, I kind of didn't. I just kind of had to go wave and, you know.
Yeah.
Enjoy the night. So I actually let it sink in. I went like, this is fucked up.
You actually, you know, talking about acting a little bit, you actually had your first role, I think, as an extra when you were 10.
Yeah.
Was acting always something you wanted to do, or was it just your friendship with Russell that kind of...
Yeah, I mean, I did it as a kid, like every kid does in school, like in drama, theater plays. But when I got out of school, I started, you know, I wanted to be in a band, you know, and I was going to be a band guy. And, you know, I never spent 10 minutes thinking about being an actor for a living. I did a couple of little theater things with friends just because they wanted me to do a little monologue show or something. I did it because it was great fun to work with them and what they're good at, you know, and learn. And then it's, again, just like the book, man, it's like, it came to me, you know. It's like, and I was happy to do it because, you know, I got to do my first acting gig was on the biggest budget movie
ever. Yeah,
that they were doing that year with you know, small time directors like Ridley Scott.
And just a few no-name actors like Russell and Kate.
Yeah, Russell and Kate.
Best place to get cod tongue?
Oh, Petty Harbor.
Petty Harbor?
Yeah.
Petty Harbor cod tongue?
Yeah. No question. Chafe's Landing restaurant has been fantastic.
Is that the Perry Chafe's family?
They're related, yeah. Yeah. They're the Chafe's that run Chafe's Landing and Petty Harbor, I think they're Perry's second cousins. It's a great little restaurant. It's fantastic. Yeah.
Are you still the boy on the bridge?
Yeah.
In many ways?
Everywhere. Yeah, still wondering which way to go. Still fascinated by what's coming next. Still can't believe my luck. Still eager to find out what other people do and how they do it and what time they do it and how they do that. And then, you know, always going somewhere and always coming home.
Speaking of what's coming next, I know you're just putting the finishing touches on a new solo album.
Yep.
What can we expect from that?
It's going to be a real cool combination of the traditional music I grew up with, mandolins and accordions, and a collaboration with the biggest pop music makers of the day, you know, in Canada. I worked a lot with a guy named Todd Salter, who just did the Lights record and did Walk Off the Earth, and that kind of looked, especially the Walk Off the Earth one I was drawn to because it's these huge pop songs on the radio that are driven by ukuleles and mandolins and stuff, you know, and it's exactly what I like.
Well, Alan Doyle, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks so much.
Pleasure to talk to you, too.
That was Great Big C, frontman and author of the new memoir, Where I Belong, Alan Doyle. And he'll be coming to Vancouver on a solo tour in March, I believe. You can go to alanthomasdoyle.com. You are listening to Endeavors on CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby. Next up, actor Mark Pellegrino.
Mark Pellegrino, thanks for joining me today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, you play Jedediah Price on The Tomorrow People, who's been described as the villain of the show, if you will. How would you describe what type of person he is?
I think Jedediah is a very conflicted guy. I think he's driven by the idea that the Tomorrow People will eventually succeed in wiping out humanity, but he is also torn by loyalties to his family, to his brother, to Tomorrow People who are not, don't fit into the profile that he's put them in, and so that causes quite a bit of psychic angst and forced compartmentalization of what he has to do. And I think he's at odds with the guy who may be the villain, the founder, who's decidedly unconflicted about his worldview and goals.
Now, Tomorrow People is a sci-fi show, and especially in this town, I find there are sci-fi shows everywhere. What do you think it is about that specific genre that appeals to people, and what have you noticed about the fans of that genre in this town?
Well, I'll take the second part of that first. The fans are very passionate. They're very literate with respect to the genre and very in tune with the minutiae of the shows that they watch. So they really keep you on your toes. And they're very loyal as well. So if they like you and they like a show, they'll be very activist in expressing that to networks and shows all around. So I love the sci-fi fans. They're pretty phenomenal. I think what's interesting about sci-fi is that it's a genre that enables you to deal with all kinds of touchy social issues in a way that, you know, makes it palatable and interesting and not offensive to people, you know. Like comedy can deal with touchy social issues or politically incorrect phenomenon, and you know, you can take it without getting upset. Sci-fi can do the same thing. You know, I think there's elements, even though our show is largely action-oriented, I mean, there's elements of dealing with prejudice and bigotry and prejudging people based on assessments of who they are that have nothing to do with their character. And I think, you know, I think those are very important subjects, and they're dealt with in a stealth way because it gets, you know, it doesn't get lost in, but it's hidden in the sci-fi elements. So, and I think you can deal with very interesting topics in sci-fi.
Another huge sci-fi show that you've been a part of is Supernatural. There are many, many Supernatural fans. It's almost just obscene in this town, just the kind of reception that show has. What was it like being a part of that show? Did that bring you to a whole new audience?
I think so. I mean, the Supernatural fans are amazing. They really embrace you if they like you. And, yeah, it's a whole new phenomenon. It is a worldwide phenomenon. You'd be surprised at the number of people that really love the show. And the mythology is really, really great. I mean, I loved what they did with Lucifer. I love how they wrote him as a human character, as a truthful character, not arch, you know, and kind of impish and smiling through his revenge, you know, in a way. And I liked that. I thought it was an unconventional take on the mythology of Lucifer. So yeah, it's a great show. You know, the guys are great, very professional, and very funny, and fun to work with. And it's like a big family now.
Have you had any strange fan encounters?
You know, I get asked that question from time to time, and I actually have not had any strange fan encounters. I'm happy to say. So I'm still in the honeymoon phase of fandom. Although I get a few weird, you know, tweets that, you know, I don't like, because my daughter reads the tweets time and time, so I get some weird stuff.
Do you know anything about the potential Supernatural spinoff?
Oh my God, no. Tell me more.
I just read that this season they could use an episode as a backdoor pilot, but that's it.
I think I did hear something about this at one of the conventions. But I don't remember anything beyond that there's going to be some kind of spinoff. Are they using a character from...
They're I think they're going to be introducing a character in an episode later this season. And then that character will serve as the spinoff. There's not a lot of information about it. It was just something that I read.
Wow.
Now, Lucifer, Jedediah, this is not your first time playing... A dark character. You've done Dexter, you've done in Cold Blood. Is there something specifically that appeals to you about playing that side of humanity?
Well, you know, they're just more complicated, I think. You know, they've got a lot more stuff going on, and they're so torn, you know, psychologically, that it just, for me, makes just more interesting stuff to delve into and to do imagination homework with, you know. And and I think story-wise, they drive the story. Without these passionate, messed-up characters pursuing what they think is right, then the heroes would never have to become heroic. So, you know, they're more interesting to me.
Now, I read that, like a lot of actors, you don't watch your own shows. I think I've read that you've never seen Dexter. Why is that? Is it just a way of you're done with it and you want to move on to something new?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's so much great TV out there. I have to catch up. It's more an issue of time, you know. And I'm a teacher. I teach acting, so and I probably should, as part of my homework, start integrating that, you know, looking at some of these great TV shows. But I end up, you know, studying a play or working on some other project, you know, with my wife or something. So it's really a matter of time. that makes me not be able to watch it. I do study the episodes that I'm in. I watch what works and what doesn't work. And with the Tomorrow People, I've seen every episode a couple of times, so I actually am following it now, in part because, you know, I'm a part of the cast in a way that I haven't been before, so I'm really entangled in the story in a way that I wasn't before.
I know you also teach a Meisner class. What, and I know you studied Meisner in the past, but what about Meisner made you want to bring that method to a younger generation of actors?
You know, it's I think the best method at getting organic and real, because it's all about being in the moment. And it not only helps you with respect to your acting, because listening is fundamental to the Meisner technique, it helps you in life. You know, to get in touch with your authentic self is part of the Meisner technique. That helps you in life. To listen like nobody's business, like you're a pro at it, is great for your acting, but it helps you in life. You know, a fertile imagination and sensitivity, all that helps your acting and it helps you in life. So that's part of the reason I want to bring it to the younger generation. And Meisner was part of a theatrical tradition that comes all the way down from Stanislavski in the Moscow Art Theater. He was part of the group theater in the 40s that changed the face of American acting. I mean, Lee Strasberg, Stella Adler, Sanford Meisner, Ilya Kazan, all came out of that theater group. And they're the ones that brought us James Dean and Marlon Brando and De Niro and Meryl Streep. And everybody that we consider icons came out of that theatrical tradition. And many of them, the Duvalls, John Voight, the Gregory Pecks, studied under Meisner.
So, speaking of good TV shows that you watch, I've heard that you're a Gleek.
You did. Well, I don't know if I would consider myself that, but I do like it.
How does someone like yourself get into that show?
You know, my wife was watching it, so I started watching it. And I got caught up in it. The music was really, really good. And they bought, like, you know, CDs, so I put them in my car and would listen to them. You know, and my daughter was really into it, so, you know, that dragged me into it. Even, you know, as busy as I am, I'd sit and watch a show or two.
In the future, could we see Mark Pellegrino sing his way onto the show?
Oh, my God, I'm terrified of that. I used to, you know, it's bad enough that the fans of Supernatural have gotten me to do karaoke, so I've done that. And it's fun, but I can't imagine. Those guys are so talented, you know, and they do so much each show. I can't imagine being able to do all that. You know, that's a lot of stuff to keep in your brain pan.
Speaking of singing, I believe I read somewhere that you've recently been turned on to the music of One Direction.
Yeah.
Please tell me that was your daughter that turned you on to that.
That was. But what happened was I saw that damn movie, you know, and it was really good. Those kids are kind of cool. I liked them. I liked Niall and I liked Harry a lot. I thought they were funny and advanced. You know, I mean, God, they broke it when they were about 16 or so, and to have that kind of composure under that kind of limelight is really remarkable. So, you know, I don't know. Even if it was just propaganda and it was well produced, and, you know, those guys aren't anything like that, I got the sense that they were really, you know, down to earth and hadn't lost touch with their roots.
Back to the Tomorrow People for a second, and speaking of other TV shows, you've mentioned that you've watched all of the Tomorrow People. Did you go back and look at the original British series at all?
I did not, just because I thought the tone and mood was so different, and I think the target audience was very different back in the 70s. It was pretty much a kid show, yeah, from what I understand. And I know the character of Jedekiah was very different, And so I thought we were just doing our own thing, even though we're probably using, you know, the template of the show to jump off from. It was going to become our own modernized version of it. I know we have characters that have made cameo appearances in the show that are from the original show.
And that was Mark Pellegrino. This has been Endeavors on TGSF 90.1 FM. Stay tuned for Jambalaya with Bo. The final interview you'll hear is from filmmaker Robert May, who made the documentary Kids for Cash. This was back in March of this year. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Bye, everybody. Bye. You Don't Love Me by The Wild Feathers, and a little later on you'll be hearing from Taylor Byrne Film, the station agent, and they had spent years there, and the judges had received millions of dollars in kickbacks from the privately owned juvenile detention centers, and most of the kids were sent there in their early teens. He is Robert May, and I spoke with him last week.
Right?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm here with Robert May, director of Kids for Cash. Hello.
Hey, Dan. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing well. I mean, we're just getting ready to birth our film after 4.5 years, and, you know, it feels good to finally introduce this film to its audience.
This was, as you said, a 4.5 year process. Take us through a little bit of it from conception to final birth.
Well, my producing partner and I were developing a fiction film about greed, power, children, and money. I swear, that's what we were developing. And we had a script that we've been working on for a couple of years. And when the scandal broke, which is in January of 2009, and, you know, I saw it first in the newspaper, and I'm like, what the heck is this? And then the next day, it was just more bombardment of the media of the story. And then it was on television, and it made international headlines. It was in the front page of the New York Times, and on and on and on. And we were like, wait, like, we've got a story that's developing in front of us about power and greed and children and money right here. And, you know, my offices are in New York City, but we were actually in Pennsylvania on a story retreat. And the other thing, oddity, is that I live in Luzerne County, Pennsylvania, where this story actually took place. So all of these things started to converge, and my producing partner and I, Lauren Timmons, we said, you know what, if we could get access to both villains and victims here, which we thought would be impossible, we'll take this on. And literally, that's what happened. We took it on.
How important was it for you, for the integrity of the film, that you got the judges to talk?
We simply wouldn't have made the movie without access to the judges, because as powerful as the kids' stories were anticipated to be, I mean, we just felt they would probably be powerful. We also felt like, who's going to want to see a film about, you know, these kids who went through all of these challenges? Because it's sort of a one-dimensional story, and, you know, that's not what people are entertained by. People are entertained by stories with twists and turns. You know, they're especially like in thriller kind of stories. You know, people are entertained by the villain and the victim and all that kind of thing. So we just thought we had to have the villain to do the story. Otherwise, we wouldn't have a multidimensional story.
In particular, with Chivarella, it seemed like that his self justification even incriminated him more.
Some people say that, and some people say the opposite. The one thing that I find so fascinating about this film, and, you know, research audiences as we were completing the film, a full 50% of the people that see the film have some empathy for the villain, and the other 50% wonder, what movie did they just see? There have been outbursts within audiences at the end for the research screenings that literally audiences are arguing among themselves about, you know, what just happened here. And quite frankly, I find that pretty fascinating.
I was talking with actually my dad the other day about this case, and we were discussing about whether or not Conahan and Chivarella's sentences were either too extreme in proportion for the crime, or whether they were harsher because, in fact, they were judges and therefore had a duty to uphold the law, which they broke.
Well, first of all, in the federal system, this is the way it works. If you, when you're indicted in the federal system, they try to get you to plead guilty, because if you look at all the various federal indictments that are handed down in a given year, you'll see more people who plead guilty than you do go to trial. And so, I assume there's a lot of reasons for it, but one thing is that if you go to trial in the federal system and lose, you get a stiffer sentence automatically, just for losing, just for defending yourself. So that's one thing. In Chivarella's case, he was, the years started lumping on. The other thing is, of course, they were judges, and they violated the public trust, and there isn't any sympathy for that. When you're a judge and you violate the oath and you go before other judges, not a good thing. And I think that it ends up that they got very severe sentences. And the difference between the two, 28 years versus 17 and a half, is a pretty remarkable difference between the two, because it also means that for Chivarella, he's in a much higher security prison, federal prison, than Conahan is. Conahan is in a much lower level prison because of the sentencing.
Does that bring about, do you think, that problems with the justice system as a whole in the states?
Yes, I do. Because first of all, we jail more adults in this country than any other country in the world, and we also jail more children than any other country in the world. Why is that? Why do we live in a country where we, as soon as someone's accused of a crime, we call them guilty? It depends on what crime it is, too, because if it's a heinous crime, they're more than guilty. They should be killed on the spot. I mean, we've become a society that wants blood, and when there's no more blood, we want more blood from somebody, because we just have to have blood. And I think that's who we've become. And I think we've become much less about what happened here and much more about making examples out of people. That's what happened to the kids. I mean, the kids were accused of this and that, and we were afraid the kids are going to do this and that, and we want to make examples out of them, so we persecute them. It's what we do. It's the same mentality, I think.
Do you feel that, and it should be pointed out that there are other two players in this case, the lawyer and, well, the owner of the facility and the builder.
Yeah.
And they were also sentenced, but it seems to me that their sentences were far less severe than those of the judges, even though they were involved in the actual bribes as well.
Well, that's right. Robert Powell, who is the lawyer, he already spent his time in federal prison, and then he went to a halfway house, and he's out. The builder, Robert Miracle, he hasn't been sentenced yet. In fact, his sentencing date was set for February 26th. Of this year, but now the federal government has come in and thinks that he violated the terms of his plea deal, whatever that means, we don't know yet. So there's speculation as to what will happen and how, many years or months or whatever he'll get. Well, the thing is, though, the judges are supposed to be, withholding the law, not above the law, and I think that that's a big deal. I mean, the judge breaks the law and a regular citizen breaks the law. I think society feels like, well, the judge has to have more years than the regular citizen. That's why, like, honest services fraud is something that sometimes officials are charged with, because while I guess a regular person could be charged with honest services fraud, like an employee who decides to defraud his employer of, something, but it's mostly for politicians who defraud the citizens of their honest services, and so that's the judges were convicted on that, basically.
What do you make of the fact that Powell actually served less time than many of the kids?
That's right. That you're absolutely right. That Powell went away for less time, and he may even get his law license back and so forth, while the kids are struggling to just regain a life because their adolescence was pulled out from under them. And that's what happens. That's what happens when we become draconian with kids. While they're still developing, while most kids are trying to figure out life in general, in these cases, when we put kids into, take them from their families and put them in these jails, basically, we rob them of their adolescence, which they never will get back, ever. Paul might get his law license back, but the kids are never going to get their adolescence back.
It seems to me it was striking, considering that all this was discovered sort of late 2008, early 2009, and then by 2011 it was over. It seemed to happen remarkably quickly.
Do you mean the trial,
from the time that the charges were first announced to the trial to the sentencing? I mean, a year and a half, 2 years in the grand scheme of things is a pretty quick time.
Yeah, I suppose so. I can tell you, as we were following it, we thought it would never end because it was like one thing after another. But you're right. I think that it followed a certain urgency in its trajectory.
Talk about this. After these guys were sentenced, they used something called the King's Bench jurisdiction, in where all of Chivarella's cases were reviewed. Can you shed a little more light into that?
Yes, the King's Bench warrant or jurisdiction, the Juvenile Law Center based in Philadelphia, who are really the heroes in the film, when they felt that Chivarella was treating kids more harshly than he ought to be, and there were kids that were there without lawyers and so forth, they filed a King's Bench petition before the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. And the Pennsylvania Supreme Court basically ignored it. And they continued to ignore it, until the federal government handed down or basically announced the scandal and announced that these judges were being accused of taking all this money. Then the Supreme Court instantaneously turned around and granted the King's Bench petition, which meant that the Supreme Court, would appoint another judge to come in and find out what was going on, look at these various cases, and take them over, if you will, remove them from the jurisdiction of Luzerne County and put it under the jurisdiction, in essence, of the state Supreme Court. And that's what happened.
I think one aspect that's important to delve into, and you mentioned it a little bit, is the social impact that the sentencing had on these kids. I believe it was Charlie that said he got into a little bit of small-time trouble with drugs because of, you know, the effects of living in this prison system for so long. What does it do to an adolescent's mentality?
Well, it's funny because we found out that there are more kids that are first introduced to drugs when they get in juvenile detention. That's when many kids are actually first introduced to drugs, which is astonishing when you think about it. Of course, some kids get in there because of it. Other kids learn it from there. And I think that there's this sense of camaraderie that one of our kids talks about, like a different kid, Justin, who learned to do drugs in the system. Well, look, he didn't have any friends anymore. For goodness sake, he was pulled out of school. He's sitting in a juvenile detention boot camp, basically for 9 months, and he's meeting these other kids. And some of the kids did bad things, some of them didn't. But, you know, there's a curiosity about the kids that did the really bad things. So there's a friendship that occurs with them. And then, of course, if there's drugs, like, well, why not? Yeah. I mean, everyone else has pushed them aside. You know, friendships are still something that it's in our DNA. So they get exposed to all sorts of